medium density housing, transit-oriented development, mixed use, the principles of new urbanism have reached Tamaki Makaurau. These core tenets of urban design have become accepted as international best practice for creating better communities and more livable urban spaces. So how exactly does a Te Ao Māori perspective factor in?
Yeah, so we're here at Vinegar Lane some 4 years after we started the process. So 31 different lots formed on the site around Vinegar Lane. Now Vinegar Lane is named after the DYC vinegar factory that was on the site.
Did it fill the whole site?
Yes. So it was here from late 1800s to 1950s, I think, 1960s. And interestingly, we found out quite a bit later that the factory itself was made of totara.
It's a beautiful facade. Tell me about this shape here.
So there's a number of references, and from the black concrete, obviously just relating to the black volcanic soils or cones of Tamaki Makaurau, and obviously the timber referencing initially being totara, but even as another species, it still speaks to the New Zealand vernacular of a vertical house.
And it's a nod to the heritage of this space.
Yeah. The clients actually came to us, they had a very modest budget at the start, and we designed something that was quite striking but modest, and they sort of said, no, we want this to be a statement, so show us what that looks like.
Show us what you can do.
Yeah, so we ended up doing this giant X, basically, which is a really cool sort of device that, because those are bedrooms behind there, that, and they've got louvered screens for privacy to the street, so it's still got a practical purpose. We like everything at Tor to have not just an aesthetic kind of idea, there's usually some kind of concept or idea behind that, and then a practical reason as well. So if we're standing virtually at the near the top of Vinegar Lane itself and looking basically due north, we've got three sites and two of them are visible right now. So straight ahead is Aria Apartments, Vinegar Lane. really dense for the site, so only 376 square meter footprint, and we managed to get 20 apartments on there. Quite an affordable design. That's actually quite a lot of young people are actually occupying that building, which is what we really want. What we wanted, that was our vision, to kind of mix up this whole sort of precinct. I mean, interestingly, there's a design panel and we got quite a bit of resistance with having so many apartments, and it was like, what minimum standards are you using? And we said, well, have you been to Copenhagen? Have you been to Tokyo? Have you, you know, the rest of the world has 30 square metre apartments and they function quite well. And so we didn't want this to be, you know, 120 square metre foot plates at $1.5 million. That's not affordable. A number of the apartments in Lot 7 were just over $400,000. It's pretty amazing value for Ponsonby anyway. We were really proud of, you know, we hung on to our guns were there. They were quite bolshy in terms of these should be bigger, and we basically said no.
How did you get that across the line?
I think that they listened to the rationale. It's just like, we want this to be a vibrant mix. You know, the whole idea is the ground level. All of these sites have an option to make them either residential or some kind of commercial use. The key sites, like the corner ones, have a list of functions that they were allowed, for example, a cafe or an art gallery. So it was very much about creating this urban kind of village. And so we were like, if you want that to happen, we've got to have people that live here.
Now, is this all one developer or a variety of developers working together?
So interestingly, Vinegar Lane, the whole precinct was in Environment Corp for about two decades, because the initial developer that bought it from the DYC company had really awful visions of a big faux giant villa, three levels, monolithic, you know, colonial, you know, filigrees and polystyrene window surrounds. So Ponsonby got very, very angry and like all good community groups, fought it off. And then so actually Progressive came around in 2007 and bought the site and said, well, how about we want to do a commercial development on the front, but let's do something different on the back. So it was a combination of Isthmus Group, an evolution of Rhubarb Lane, which sort of happened about 10 years prior to that, and that had a lot of the top architects like Pip Cheshire and Pete Bosley and stuff involved, but it fell over because it was leasehold land. This is freehold, so it's really, really great. So 31 different sites, and up to 16 metres vertical. So quite a neat idea, actually.
I mean, so this really exemplifies the principles of mixed-use development, which is where Urban Design Internationally is going and where it's going in this city. For those who don't know, could you explain what mixed-use development is?
Yeah, so mixed-use is something that we, as Toa as a practice, really embrace. It's the idea of Māori design principles of old, of, you know, a vertical papakāinga. You know, papakāinga where we worked on site, we lived, we ate, we played, we educated, we trained for war. You know, everything was done within the pā. And so the idea of taking that vertically is really quite exciting for us.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Nau mai haere mai ki te Indigenous Urbanism. Aotearoa Edition, Episode 8. I'm your host, Jay Kake, and this is Indigenous Urbanism. Stories about the spaces we inhabit and the community drivers and practitioners who are shaping those environments and decolonizing through design. On this episode of Indigenous Urbanism, we visit the Vinegar Lane precinct in inner city Ponsonby and learn about how a bicultural design ethos has been successfully applied to multi-residential housing within a mixed-use development. We spoke with Nick Dalton, Nō Ngāti Pukiao Rawako Ngāti Whakoe, founding director of Toa Architects, a firm based in Tāmaki Makaurau. Toa are the architects for three of the buildings within the Vinegar Lane precinct: Lot 4, Aria Apartments, and Rua Tako.
Ko Namatate Maunga, ko Rotorunui a Kahamatamomo te roto, ko Te Arata Waka, ko Ngāti Whakaue te hapu, ko Nicholas Dalton taku ingoa.
So you've talked a little bit about this project here. What's the name of that one?
So it's just Lot 4.
Lot 4, okay.
Lot 4 Vinegar Lane, yeah.
Okay, well, we've talked about Lot 4 a little bit. Do you want to talk a bit about Aria? So you talked about smaller apartment size and affordability and kind of creating these vibrant communities. Could you tell me about the inspiration behind the facade design? Because that's quite striking.
Yeah, totally. Let's
walk and talk.
A little bit closer. It being a key corner site, and I guess it was a bit of give and take with the design panel and the fact that they wanted something great there, you know? And it was interesting that, again, there was resistance. They had sort of ideas of the vertical connection being to the front corner, and we're just like, why would you do that? We find that really, really quite strange. So we wanted a facade which kind of activated, but also spoke to the idea of, or looking certainly at a Māori reference, so geometric tānakor or a pātiki, you know, the school of flounder. One of the jurors from the NZIA sort of said, well, what relevance does that have? And I said, well, the whole idea of the pātiki, the school of flounder, is it's about whānau, but it's also about prosperity. So going, you know, being together. And so that idea that even though it's an apartment, there's actually many kind of family, it's a community in itself. And so that idea of expressing that on the facade is not only acknowledgement of this really kind of age-old Māori archetype or philosophy, but, or kaupapa, sorry, in a modern context, you know? So yeah, really, really wrapped with how it's turned out.
Well, it looks really beautiful. Are there communal spaces within the building?
We initially, when we were going through the feasibility start, we did have a roof terrace. We found that it did actually add quite a lot of cost, which meant, you know, those affordable units would actually no longer be affordable. And plus, I think in the context, we've got to remember in the context of Vinegar Lane, there's actually a central courtyard there, which is landscaped, and so and some of the spaces on ground level are protected in terms of they have to be a communal use.
So the whole ground plane is kind of your communal space.
Yeah, so I think that we found kind of solace in that.
And you can do that because it's a precinct rather than just a building in isolation.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, if there wasn't anything around, we'd probably be pushing harder for that idea of having that space for gathering.
Well, context is everything.
Build up.
Do you have any ideas what this tenancy underneath might end up being?
Well, we initially designed it as a cafe. So if you see from the original renders, we had seats and tables on the ground floor, out on the street here. Unfortunately, because I think one of the failings of the setup of the precinct is there's no time restriction on when these guys have to have things built. So as you can see, this side of the street is completely intact, which is great, but actually a lot of the site is still a construction site. So I think that we're going to find that a lot of the spaces are going to be empty or not, as they will end up in the next few years.
And it's tricky as the architect because you don't have a lot of control or any over that. Hey, I like the steel. Yeah, tell me about that.
Well, I grew up in the country. I grew up in a village called Mamaku, and so the whole idea of, you know, particularly our Pākehā heritage is the idea of the pioneer, you know, the number eight wire, the agriculture, the shearing sheds. And so you'll find that a lot with a lot of our projects is we have this really kind of polished part to it, and then we've got this kind of agricultural sort of reference or homage. And I hate glass balustrades. I think they're really kind of, they get dirty and they're just kind of never, they're supposed to not be there, but they're there. Our whole idea of a galvanized steel angle was kind of grunty and rough and raw and just kind of cool.
But then it's kind of set against the timber, and it's, I don't know, which feels warmer and kind of more.
Yeah, so definitely the timber inserts inside those balconies were really important to us to make that warm reference. And again, it was really important that the apartments that we do have that feeling, you know, that feeling of refuge, of being home, of, you know, being safe and warm.
And what's the, something I always find challenging when I stay in the city is that it's really noisy and it's hard to rest. What is the acoustics like in these apartments?
Really, really good. So everything's double glazed, of course. Aria's Homestar 6. I think code is like Homestar 3.5. So it's basically double code, which again, we're quite proud of. Yeah, it works not only from a thermal performance, but also acoustics as well.
So if I stayed here, I'd get a good night's sleep.
Yeah. I think it's really important that the whole idea of threshold, of welcoming, manaakitanga, this double height entry, you know, if you look up purely developer driven project, there would be an apartment. Yeah. We're looking at basically thousands of dollars of someone's profit, which has been removed for, you know, the enjoyment of everyone in the building.
Yeah, this entry space feels really good. It's really legible from the street, so you know where the entrance is. And you do feel like it really is a portal or a threshold. And I mean, what does that do as you step through something like this? What does it do to your frame of mind if there's somebody living here?
Well, I think that for us, again, it's trying to create things that aren't bottom line driven, that are about a place to live, that idea that you honour home, or that sense of belonging, or that sense of just, it's somewhere a little bit more special than, you know, a concrete box that that everything's based on minimum. So we're quite proud of that. You come home every day and it's this really beautiful, warm entrance, and it's everyone's, you know. We've just won a number of awards for Aria, and so we're really, really happy that the industry and our peers have kind of endorsed it.
So this one's obviously the kind of star of the show, and it's won all sorts of accolades, but you said there's a third project as well?
There was a lot of construction noise outside. The development is still under construction, so we stepped into a colleague's office, located within the Vinegar Lane precinct, to continue our kōrero.
So tell me about the third building in the Vinegar precinct.
Yeah, interestingly, 88 square metre footprint, only 6 metres wide. A different owner who's pretty much a first time developer. So lot 20, and so we call it Ruatako for Māori for 20. And we actually had a giant kind of black volcanic concrete lift shaft on the front of the building with Ruatako embedded in that. And interestingly, the clients were Pākehā, and they were, "Oh, Ruatako, I remember that at school, you know." But, you know, and they laughed, but they kind of went, "Oh, I get it." And they were, you know, they appreciated it, and they were running with us on that, so.
Well, we're at such a different point in time, I think, where Māori about, like, really embracing these kind of things.
Yeah,
I completely. Think that's relatively recent.
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, I think that they're, like, you know, for us, we're starting to, as a practice, change our language. We have te reo lessons for the whole office every 2 weeks, and it's really beautiful because we not only talk about the reo, but actually the questions of whakapapa and how you do your pepeha if you're not Māori, you know.
It's also embedded in it, and I think if you're working alongside non-Māori as you are, it becomes kind of a treaty conversation and understanding our relationship and what situates us here and what gives everyone the right to be here together.
Yeah, and interestingly, this thing kind of came up about, you know, and I always sort of said, there are Pākehā that love this land, that love Aotearoa, and so, you know, what can they sort of reference themselves with a bit more of a deeper connection? And so one of the things that came up, which I already had a bit of a handle on, was tangata tiriti. And I just thought, you know, people of not only the treaty, but the Māori version of the treaty is a very powerful kind of term. And there are a number of people on staff that were like, you know, the treaty is our founding document. And they're really opposed to the idea of becoming a republic because that's us forever, you know. And I just thought that was quite a beautiful thing, particularly to come from a non-Māori. To say that and say, I am tangata tiriti, and I think that that's a huge kind of generational shift.
And understanding and being confident in the fact that the identity is in relation to Māori culture and to this place, and that that's a positive strength-based thing for them, as well as everyone else.
Yeah.
It really strikes me that you know, your practice is very much a bicultural approach, and that comes through quite clearly in all of your work and when I hear you talk about your work.
Yeah, kia ora. I mean, it's we've sort of done a lot of reflection over the last little while, and where we came to in terms of our mission statement was the idea of creating an architecture which is of Aotearoa and all that that encompasses. So whilst it doesn't sort of label anything Māori, it's embedded because it's a Māori term and it's a Māori kind of idea. Kupe's wife naming, you know, what she saw in front of her, which is a different vision from what they had in the islands, the long, long white cloud. Pretty beautiful.
What does that mean for you to be able to contribute back to your own people?
It means a lot. It means, I mean, I've got a broad definition of my own people because, you know, I am Pākehā and I am Māori. So, you know, I actually, the first broad definition of my people are anyone that loves this land, you know. So I know some Pākehā that absolutely love this land. One thread happened, I remember watching the news, and it was a Pākehā lady in Christchurch, and she was in the red zone, and she was actually sitting in the land where her house once was. And it was a garden that was basically, it's not allowed to be built on again, but she would go back there and maintain this garden like it was her own. And she welled up, you know, and they asked her, why are you doing this? You don't own it anymore, you were paid out, you've built a new house, it's across town, why do you come back here? And whilst her description wasn't, this is my tūranga waiwai, that's essentially what she felt. She welled up, she said, I love this land, I love this. I respond well to that, you know, I think that is beautiful. I don't think it's necessarily about whakapapa as such, it is how you relate as a human to this whenua.
Combination of both, and that both of those are valid.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
So another thing that I wanted to ask you about is Māori modular housing.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, look, it's something that I've probably been thinking about for a very long time, and I guess it's kind of drawn from a number of influences, but I guess the main thing that it responds to is I believe there are two fundamental parts to the housing crisis. There is a housing crisis, by the way.
Well, I don't hear anyone denying it so loudly anymore.
Yeah. So, but what's interesting is I feel one is obviously supply and just having enough houses and bedrooms for our whānau and for all our people. It's pretty horrible when you actually look at the raw numbers of, at most, we're doing 23,000 residences per year. That's nationwide. And if we're immigrating 60,000, you know, there's a huge deficit there, you know. And so people are being displaced. That's the top problem in terms of the housing crisis. But the second part, I feel, is probably more problematic, has a longer term flow-on effect or negative impact, and that's actually the quality of what we build. So we can build 100,000 houses or 100,000 shelters, but if they don't respond to the climate, to the culture, to making communities, we're kind of creating another problem in a way. We're sort of creating shelter, but not creating communities. MMH is born out of that. It's like, how do we respond to those two things? So working with New Zealand's largest builder, which is Mike Greer Homes,
and they are taking architecturally designed houses and they're largely putting them through their factory so they can make up to 5 kit sets per day.
That's very fast. And how long does it take to erect those?
1 month.
That's really fast.
Yeah. So we can have a house completed within a month, and that's turnkey with all your appliances, everything in there ready to live. So excited. Yeah, the MMH will have a national consent, so basically they'll have a building consent already.
Now, is that a variety of different typologies or...?
Yep, so we've got a 1, a 2, a 3 and a 4 bedroom, all one level, and then we've got a 3 and a 4 bedroom, 2 level, and then we're looking to stack them as well, so up to 3 levels of 1 bedroom, 2 bedroom, 3 bedroom, so...
So you can go up to the sort of medium density?
Yeah.
And what's the per metre square build cost?
It's quite comparable. I mean, we it was something that we really were challenged with in terms of I wanted it to be affordable. So we were looking at, how do we make it cheaper? But we've sort of reached this point where we didn't want to compromise on sourcing as many materials from Aotearoa as possible. We wanted the quality to be high. We wanted them to be above code, which is, New Zealand Building Code is unfortunately the worst allowable by law in the world. There was a level of quality that we didn't want to go below. Still in the kind of early to mid 2000s per square metre, which is pretty good, but what tips it over the scale is that if you're getting it in a month...
It's the speed and the quality.
It's the speed and the quality together that I think makes it a really desirable package, and the fact that, in Auckland it's rent for a family's $30,000, so 1 year is $30,000 in your pocket.
Well, what's that thing? Do you want it fast, cheap, or good quality?
Yeah.
You can only pick two, and that seems to be pretty true.
Yes. So the first prototype is only a month away now. So we are taking orders from all over the country, and watch this space.
You can find out more about ARIA Apartments and other Toa Architects projects at Toa. That's toa.net.nz. Indigenous Urbanism is a production of Te Matapihi. Sandy Wakefield does our sound recording, editing and mixing. Our theme was composed by Thomas Burton. I'm Jade Kake, your host and executive producer. For more information about today's show and other episodes of Indigenous Urbanism, go to indigenousurbanism.net. You can drop us a line at info@indigenousurbanism.net. And if you like what you're hearing, please give us a review or rating on iTunes. Coming up next on Indigenous Urbanism, we visit the site of the upcoming Pauā Whanake development in Point England, which will see 300 homes and a new marae built on treaty settlement land.
What is the point of difference that we bring? The point of difference that we bring is that it's not about creating housing alone, it's about creating a community. For Ngāti Pauā and for the leadership of Ngāti Pauā, it's just to continue to move forward and based on our principles of tika, doing things correct, doing things right, pono, just be honest to ourselves and honest to others as well. But the important thing is the aroha. Aroha can take many forms, but for us it's part about compassion.